Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey on Reality Check Radio. Welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. It's good to be here again.
And we've had a few suggestions come in to rename the show because it's on Monday. It's not quite the weekly roundup anymore. We haven't locked in a name change, but we did have someone suggest the RCR Retrospect. And another one that's come through, which I quite like actually, is Monday's Moot Points. So Moot Points might be an interesting way to go. We will decide on a rename in a little while because I've got two more weeks after this and I'll be on holiday for a little bit. So I'm just giving everybody a heads up. We don't know what's going to happen then. But at some point when I come back after my holiday, we will decide on the new name. I appreciate everyone who sent that in and appreciate all of the text messages and emails that we get and feedback will be dealt with in the mailbag with Amy later on. So you can text us on 2057 or email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And as usual, we'll get into a few international issues before we get into the domestic issues that we've selected from last week to go through. And one of the interesting developments in a story that we have been talking about for a few weeks around the Haitian migrants in the United States. And the latest development is that they are taking Trump to court. So they've said that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have libeled them as a group, and they've committed some kind of group hate crime. Not quite sure how that works in the United States. But yeah, what do you think of that kind of development in this context? And I guess maybe around free speech and especially political speech.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but can you legally label a group with something that is, you know, could potentially damage their reputation, but is true? So we've seen some of the videos. I mean, there is some of this cat eating and, you know, duck gathering from the local park going on, at least some of it. I mean, probably most Haitians aren't doing that, but some are. And it's annoying the locals, and it's become an issue in the election campaign because some of the locals are, you know, upset about it. And then Trump and J.D. Vance have raised it. And it illustrates a broader point about some of the problems with mass immigration. You're bringing in people with different customs and they act differently and do things that can offend the locals, offend local sensibilities. So it's all relevant and important to talk about, and it's an important election issue. But nevertheless, speaking about it does reflect badly on the group of people in question, namely Haitian migrants. So I think it's an interesting case. It's interesting to whether you're allowed to say things that can be perceived as, you know, racist or defamatory to a group. I think you should be able to say things like that because it's true. And even if it wasn't true, if it was an honest opinion, if you honestly thought it was going on, it has some relevance to political debates. You have to be able to debate political issues, and this is a political issue. And if it turns out it's racist and you can't talk about it, that would mean you couldn't talk about important political issues. So that's why I think it's important and why I think it's a free speech issue.
And this being America, that is very, very difficult to take any kind of case like this in court. And obviously against Trump, he's being sued left, right, and center all the time. I don't really expect this to dent anything. What other predictions do you think you can make about the election? I mean, I want to say 5 or 6 weeks out now. I'm not counting exactly, but I think we're getting pretty close to the end. What's your overall view on the shape of the race?
I've predicted a Trump victory from the beginning, and I'm going to continue to predict a Trump victory. I predict there will be some sort of election shenanigans. The New York Times is already softening their readership up to expect something like we had last time with the you know, Trump appearing to be ahead and then everyone goes to bed and they wake up in the morning and Trump's somehow behind and van loads of, you know, ballots have been found amongst various, you know, inner city or migrant communities and bust into the polling stations and it's changed the result, but we're not allowed to complain about it. Surely it's all legitimate. So I expect things like that to be happening, but I think Trump will win. That's my prediction.
The polling at the moment is still fairly tight. I think the polling is actually tighter than it was in 2020, much tighter than it was in 2016. All of that bodes well for Trump, unless the polling companies have suddenly decided to factor in, you know, that Trump is more popular than they usually give him credit for. All of that will remain to be seen. Very, very hard to guess these things. But I suspect, as you've basically said, it'll be a nail biter. But likewise, I've been predicting a Trump victory as well. So we'll see if we both end up with egg on our faces. Now, if we switch over to the United Nations, I know that's not like an international country, but it's an international issue. And they've got a bunch of new pacts and compacts that they are working on. Last week, they had the a decent, I guess, regular size meeting at the UN. A few interesting speeches there as well. Listen to a little bit of Bukele's speech, where he described how the corruption that he saw in his own country is now happening in all across Western countries that are criticizing him. He's basically saying, I fixed all these corruption problems, and it's so sad to see all those Western countries now succumbing to the things that I fixed in El Salvador. That's like the one highlight from the UN. Everything else seems to be a low light. The pacts that they're pushing now are the Pact for the Future, basically cementing Agenda 2030 and Sustainable Development Goals. They're pushing a Declaration on Future Generations, which is basically a left-wing globalist wish list, you know, blah, blah, climate change, blah, blah. And then the third one is the Global Digital Compact, which seems to be a hate speech and misinformation working group with various powers to kind of bully countries into taking on hate speech and disinformation laws. And we've actually seen a number of other countries, including New Zealand, get caught up in all of this hate speech stuff. And a lot of that has been defeated, pushed back, and the United Nations want to pick that up and make hate speech a global issue.
Yes, these are huge pacts that would arrogate large sweeping powers across a broad range of issues to the United Nations. So it would take power away from sovereign governments, give those powers to the United Nations. And I mean, I've read the documents. They look like it's a wish list of things put together by like first year political science university students. And we've got politicians from the biggest, most powerful countries around the world agreeing to these. You know, they look like shoddily drafted up agreements just with huge amounts of powers. Looks like someone's, you know, a first year uni student who's hungover's come in and written it up the next morning and handed it in to the teacher, and it gives all the power to the UN and takes it away from countries. It's just unbelievable this is happening, and it's getting very little media coverage. I've seen very little media coverage of this in New Zealand. These seem like really important things that are happening that are getting very little coverage. So I think it's very concerning. And I don't want the UN in charge of regulating the internet, deciding what's hate speech and what's misinformation and being able to censor things. I don't want the UN in charge of reforming and managing the financial system and allowing it to pursue goals like climate change and basically setting up a Chinese-style social credit system by reforming the global financial system. These are huge and very important things that are going on. And it's amazing that it's not being covered and people aren't aware of it.
Yes, the people involved at the UN are largely, as you say, they come across like political science students. Basically, they come out of these Western universities, they go to the United Nations to achieve these goals, and we often get sort of washed up politicians or retired politicians who are taking the official delegates or the seats for delegates of our countries. And it's all very, very strongly slanted towards the left. And then the media ignores them because they sort of hide behind the, and I remember this with the Compact for Migration, where they said, oh, well, it's a non-binding agreement. You know, we're putting together these compacts and they're non-binding on member states. They're idealistic and it's nothing for you to worry about. And of course, then several years later, they come back and you'll get a government in your country will say, well, we're just implementing some routine legislation to make sure that we're complying with the international agreement of the United Nations that was signed by 250 countries. That's basically how this goes. It happens every single time. And here we are again. Like you said, the media don't cover it, and by the time the people find out about it, it's too late. So it's great to have RCR shining a spotlight on this and making sure that people are aware of what's happening, so that, you know, as they try to trickle this down into our political system in years to come, we can point back and say, look, we've been warning about this. Here's what they've been cooking up.
Yeah, so this is what happened with Hei Pūapua, the pact that was sort of behind a lot of the Labor government's co-government's arrangements and Three Waters and all that sort of stuff. And these pacts, they get signed up, and then you find they pop up in places like regional councils' plans. They'll be citing these UN agreements and their plans as the reason for why they're doing, you know, implementing various policies at the regional and local level. It's incredible the influence that these global instruments have, and yet the ordinary people of New Zealand and most other countries have very little involvement and knowledge about the fact that it's going on.
Yeah, and the bureaucrats at every level will just sort of slide these things in. And if anybody asks questions about it, as I said, oh, well, it's, you know, the UN, hundreds of nations, 250 nations at the UN said that we should do this. And, you know, everybody agrees that we should do this. And of course, if you get all of your left-wing political science students that end up taking up positions in local government, on local boards, on councils, and so on, we tend to have in New Zealand not enough interest from the right wing in what's going on with these councils. In council elections, we tend to say, oh, well, it's local elections. They don't have very much power. They don't matter that much. And then there's a lot of garbage that gets pushed in at the local level. And they interact between, you know, the international UN level and your very low down local level. They just keep filtering. They keep filtering it through.
Yeah, and you think it's just paperwork, and it's just people are under the impression, and it often seems like this to me even, that it's just sort of a talk fest and stuff. But actually, these documents, people are agreeing to them. They're being filtered down through the bureaucracy, like you're saying. People are implementing real things that are affecting real people's lives at local, regional, and national levels on the basis of them. So we need to keep a watchful eye on it.
To bring this down to a local level, we had some good news last week on Irish hate speech laws that have now been withdrawn. It was decided, well, we don't have consensus on this issue anymore. So that was quite a big shift there. Well, we don't have consensus on hate speech laws, so we're not going to advance hate speech laws. That's a great win. The downside is that there's still hate crime laws that they're pursuing. So they're going to add hate crime offences, but there are not going to be any hate speech offences in Ireland. So what's your reaction to this?
Well, this just shows that concerted opposition and protest activity can have an impact and stop measures like this from being passed. In Ireland, there's been lots of anti-immigration marches and pro-free speech marches. The Irish nationalists have protested about this. They, I think, deserve a significant amount of the credit for, not all of the credit, but, you know, a significant amount for having organized opposition to these measures and succeeded in stopping them. And so this is sort of an example of a dynamic, I think, that's emerging across many countries now, where you have sort of the liberal, the rights-based free speech type people and the nationalists protesting for similar causes being sort of driven together just by the nature of events. And I think that alliance could prove fruitful.
And if we head over into another part of Europe, there was another local election or federal election in Germany, the state of Brandenburg. And we had a very similar result to the previous states that I talked about. And I spoke with them, with the AfD chairman, Peter Behringer, about these other two elections. And this one, very, very similar result for them, a third of seats, very consistent here in East Germany. And I should mention as well to the listeners, I did interview someone from Ireland recently on the issues that we've talked about, Keith Woods. You can go and check out those older interviews if you haven't listened to them yet. Very interesting what's happening in both Ireland and Germany. What are your thoughts here on the local or the federal elections in Germany? Any developments you think that are worth talking about? And I don't want you to repeat yourself from the last time that we talked about it, but the only thing that I could see that was really different in this election was that it was an area where the Social Democrats, the kind of left-wing, traditional left-wing party, got the first place seats instead of the Angela Merkel's old party. I can't quite remember the name, but the Christian Democrats, basically the more conservative party. And yet the AfD clocking in at a third of seats doesn't matter whether it's an area where the traditional left is more popular or where the traditional right is more popular. AfD is performing consistently there in East Germany.
Yeah, I mean, so that's just a continuation and a reinforcement of the macro trend of the AfD and a sort of populist, nationalist, anti-immigration parties more generally across Europe and elsewhere tending to do well. I think that's all there is to really say about it.
That's right. And they're doing well because they're speaking to those issues that people really care about. And the other parties are fading because it doesn't matter which one you're voting for, you're getting the same globalist solutions. Now, if we move closer to New Zealand, we'll move right into New Zealand. We've got a few local issues to talk through this week, which is great. And one of the key themes that is going to come out in here are the institutions that we have. And I may as well start with the NZ Stats report into the trust in New Zealand institutions, which has continued to decline. I think trust in most of our major institutions are lower than they ever have been.
Yes, so Stats New Zealand have a data release that has come out within the last week or so, showing that trust in institutions continues to fall. The institutions that were particularly not trusted were the media. I think the mainstream media was the least trusted institution. Parliament was also not very trusted. Trust in the police held up relatively well. Comparatively, but the general trend there is trust in institutions falling. And another feature there in this data release was that New Zealanders' sense of belonging to the nation is also falling. So having read this data release, I'm reminded of the academic work that's been done on the effects of diversity on social trust and trust in institutions and on a feeling of belonging. So the academic literature says that as diversity in the community increases, you get falling trust in institutions and falling trust in other human beings. And as a result, you get poorer outcomes on all your normal measures of socioeconomic well-being, so lower GDP, you get lower average incomes, you get more poverty, you get more crime, you get more people doing drugs, more of these antisocial things happening. And it's basically because if people have less in common, they're less likely to interact, they're less likely to do things together. And so people become more isolated, they stick to themselves more, and you get less of these sort of voluntary associations that are really the machinery of democracy. So I just think this data release illustrates, it's just an illustration that this academic research that has been done, that this process is what is happening. It's happening in New Zealand. And similar things are happening all around the Western world. We were having this process of mass immigration and increasing diversity and multiculturalism. It is literally, as conservatives have always said and always been dismissed for, it is literally destroying the fabric of society.
And looking at these institutions that Stats NZ is tracking, basically tracking trust in the police, trust in the courts, trust in the education system, trust in the health system, trust in parliament, and trust in the media. And every single one of those categories is down. And many of them have been flat and dropping for years. Like, for instance, the media, trust in the media is consistently dropping. But it's interesting that other areas like the health system and the education system, they used to be fairly consistent. And now those are dropping quite rapidly. Trust in parliament used to, you know, increase if we look back at the numbers. And now trust in parliament has decreased quite a lot in, it was 2023. So this was last year, end of the Jacinda Ardern years, basically. Trust in the police had declined as well, which had previously been quite stable. And trust in the courts similarly had been increasing until lots of things went wrong in the last few years, and trust in the institutions have gone down. Yeah, well, one of the most interesting parts looking at this as well, I could see that overall satisfaction that people gave to Stats was very similar. So they weren't saying that the lives were less satisfied, but yet their sense of belonging had decreased. So Asian people and Pacific Islanders had decreased much, showed quite a decline in the sense of belonging in New Zealand. Maori, on the other hand, actually reported a very strong sense of belonging in New Zealand. And they don't seem to have provided a breakdown for European New Zealanders, but I guess we can only assume that either there was nothing relevant to report or, yeah, it's strange they're only reporting it for these other ethnic groups.
Well, I mean, the Broadcasting Standards Authority recently did a survey where they only reported on the results of diverse communities, and they excluded the results from, white or European New Zealanders as well. So this is a trend that's emerging from our institutions. The opinions of white people, of European New Zealanders, don't count. Only the opinions of the diverse communities count. And they don't even report what the opinions of the white or European New Zealanders are anymore, at least in these two studies.
Yeah, that's definitely an ongoing problem, and it's worth raising that problem and see if stats and other institutions make some changes in that area. The only other two items I would mention here in their report is that the sense of safety that New Zealanders have has declined and worrying about crime increased. It's possible that actions this government is taking may change that. We'll have to wait and see. But speaking of actions that the government is currently taking, the police commissioner, Andrew Koster, who's, in my opinion, one of the worst, perhaps the worst police commissioner ever, definitely not somebody that anyone listening to the show here is excited about, but we'll be glad to hear that he's gone. He left early from his role as police commissioner, but the bad news is that he wasn't fired, as he should have been. He was simply redeployed, reassigned, given a side promotion to social investment. So could you give us your thoughts on what exactly is going on here? Is the government making a smart move here? Are they making just bad appointments because they don't have the people to bring them in? It's often said that right-wing governments, conservative governments, are in office but not in power. And so we still have these terrible public servants who are just being shuffled around, committing the same mistakes no matter where they go.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Koster was police commissioner when the parliament protest happened.
That's right.
Anti-COVID parliament protest. And he was in charge of the police response to that protest. And his response was what they call a kettling. So he gradually constricted he put barriers up, the police closed in, they gradually took down some of the structures. And then finally, as the coup de grace to that protest, the police moved in, violently tore down all the protesters' tents, and they used tear gas and they used pepper spray. I was there. I went down for a look. I was there firsthand. I saw they were pretty rough. They were pretty rough down there. There were a lot of people who were blinded by police spraying various things in their eyes. They were very rough when they were ripping the tents down. And he was the guy ultimately who made the decision to do that. And he was undoubtedly being told to do that by the politicians, by Jacinda Ardern, by Trevor Mallard, by all the other people in there who didn't like that protest being on Parliament lawn. Now, why is he being put into this social investment agency? Well, that's interesting. And, it's speculation really. So I don't have any inside information, but so he was responsible while our friend Kylie Quince was doing her report on systemic racism in the police. So that all happened under his watch, and that report.
And just to be clear, she has said openly that she's good friends with Andrew Koster and advises him on everything.
Yeah,
I should add as well, by the way, you're saying Andrew Koster and the Parliament protest. When he was reassigned, the media, they asked him just last week, what was your highlight, basically, of being police commissioner? And he said that his proudest moment was shutting down the Parliament protest. That was the highlight of his career. So,
well, I mean, the violent images that came out of the police response to that protest, particularly at the beginning when they tried and failed to remove the protesters, that did serious damage to Ardern's government, because those images went viral around the world. When they shut down the protest finally, that was one of the most brutal police actions that I think we've seen in New Zealand for a very long time. There was a very brutal police action. But anyway, so he's friends with Kylie Quince. He oversaw her writing her report on systemic racism in the police. It's an incredibly woke report that blames the disparate outcomes that Maori receive from police and in the justice system on police being racist. And as we know, that is made up. Those different outcomes happen because Maori commit more crimes, to be blunt. It's not because the police are racist. So Andrew Costa is one of these people who wants to blame it all on white people and Western institutions being racist and not on certain groups committing more crimes than others. And now he's gone into the social investment field. Now, social investment, what it's about is it's trying to find the young people who are most at risk of having bad long-term life outcomes. And you can figure this out by, they run big statistical regression analyses on the types of people who are likely to be in the prison system a long time or get into trouble in other ways. And so it's the people with the really bad backgrounds, the broken families, people who are subject to abuse in the home. So what they want to do is they want to focus in on really intensely on those few people they identify as most at risk and put support around them to try and give them better life outcomes in the long term. And the hope is that actually these people can end up costing the taxpayer, costing the system a lot of money if you don't intervene and do nothing, because they'll end up in prison, which is very costly. They'll end up in the justice system. They'll end up consuming a lot of other social services. They'll end up hurting other New Zealanders, which is costly as well. So if you can, the thinking behind social investment is if you can identify these people, you can invest quite heavily in them. Even though it's heavy investment, you might save yourself money in the long run because you'll prevent all the other harm that comes to them and comes to other people. Now, is it wise to have someone like Andrew Costa in charge of this program when he's got a blinkered view of what are the real causes of some of these social harms and what are not? I question whether he's the right person for that sort of thing.
And put this in the context as well of the fact that crime got worse while he was the police commissioner. He did absolutely nothing to reduce crime during his tenure. You know, for the Jacinda Ardern government, he was all on board with all of their agenda on being nice to criminals and nice. That's basically. He now says, oh, well, if I could get involved at the beginning stages of crime instead of the end stage of crime, then I can make a difference. But if you've completely proven that you can't make a difference at the end stage, this is going to be a disaster, presumably. And then you go, why is this government assigning him to do this? Like, what are national and ACT and New Zealand First thinking about keeping him on? I think people should have some real concerns here about what the government's doing with its staffing and with its appointments.
Yeah, I would agree.
And we've just been speaking about AUT as well, speaking about Kylie Quinns, who has a lot of influence at AUT, being the Dean of Law there. It's been revealed in this institution here that they're giving extra travel application funding to Maori and Polynesian researchers. So you get a certain number of points allocated to your travel expenses. And there's a secret policy they had that if you're Maori, you get 30 extra points. If you're a Pacific Islander, you get 20 extra points when you apply for these grants. This was presumably leaked by a staff member to the ACT Party who have made it public. And various developments have come out here. It's quite funny. But basically, they're trying to circle the wagons inside the department and trying to get the union involved. And this clearly is something that they're not embarrassed about. They're embarrassed about the fact that they've been found out, but they're not embarrassed about the policy. And this is just another ongoing part of this kind of racial hierarchy, racial preference system that these institutions are building in, that they seem to think is the problem, like you say, systemic racism and so on.
Well, I hate to say I told you so, but I speculated that this is probably what was going on your show on a previous week when we were talking about Kylie Quinns. Because you remember we were speaking about the leaked staff satisfaction survey, how the people who are involved, the staff at the AUT Law Faculty, are very unhappy with what is going on there. And I said something like, well, given what we know about Kylie Quinns and how she likes two-tier policing, two-tier justice systems, maybe she has a two-tier system of treatment for the people sitting her law classes as well. And that was funny when I said it, but that's exactly what she's doing, right? So she's giving people more money for travel and things like this, if they're a Maori or Pacific Islander. Is that correct? And then
that's correct. Yeah,
giving them...
and it's not equal as well for all Polynesians. There are two tiers of Polynesians as well. Maori rank higher than the other Pacific Islanders.
This is the intersectional system. So you've got to tick all these different category boxes, and your funding level is depends on which of the intersectional boxes you tick. So here it is in action. And how's it going? Well, staff satisfaction is very low. What does that mean? Well, it can't be that there's something wrong with the system. It must be that all the people who are dissatisfied are racists.
And going to all of the other institutions, this is largely the public service now. The government has announced a new policy that work from home is no longer automatic. There are going to be various restrictions and requirements for public servants to come into the office. My initial reaction was, of course, well, these people are my enemies, and so if they have to suffer by going into the offices when they don't want to, that sounds great to me. But I actually saw you had an interesting different take, and you changed my mind a little bit as well. So I'll let you talk about your take, and then I'll talk about what I think the impact on the public service should be.
Well, I wrote on Twitter, and when I write things on Twitter, sometimes I exaggerate them for to try and get a response out of people.
Just farming clicks, right? It's all clickbait.
Yeah, well, no, not clickbait. there's a good point in what I said. What I said on Twitter was forcing people to go into the office is like forcing them to use the horse and cart instead of the car. Because now that we have modern information technology, like, emails and Zoom meetings and Google Docs and all these things, you can ring people up, you can talk to them, you can have meetings with them, you can collaborate over large distances. And so the need to all go into the same area and meet face-to-face is less than what it was. And that's true, and I stand by that. A lot of people commented on the thread and said, well, yes, you can collaborate more easily, but there's still advantages to collaborating in person. You can read people's body languages. You have casual conversations because you bump into people that you wouldn't have, and lots of good and productive learning can come from those things. So I accept all those reasons. I'm not going to be stuck.
Yeah, and I can say personally as well, I enjoy the mix of things. You know, there's advantages and disadvantages to both.
Yeah, but the basic point is stands, I think, that there is less need than there was to all geographically co-locate in office buildings.
And being in the office does not necessarily mean being productive. You know, that's, I think, something that people miscalculate in the sense of think, well, if somebody's sitting at home, they're doing nothing. And if they're sitting in the work, they're in the office, they're doing something. But the chances are they're sitting in the office and doing nothing anyway. If they're sitting at home and doing nothing, it doesn't really matter where you put them.
I work from home full-time now, and I'm much more productive than I was when I worked in the public sector. The public sector, I found, my experience may not be typical, but I think it's pretty typical, actually, is that the public sector is a sort of a demotivational environment to work in. People who have initiative and drive and intelligence and want to make a difference, give them a few years and that'll all be gone. That'll all be gone out of them. Because it's so hard to get anything done. You've got 500 layers of bureaucracy. If you want to do anything, you've got to talk to this manager, then this manager, then this manager, then this manager. Get them all to sign off on it. You're not allowed to go out and do any projects on your own. You've got to talk to everyone across the public sector, across all these agencies, and get them all to agree with it. You've got to reflect every different perspective. Often things get done by consensus rather than thinking things through logically. So it doesn't matter if I think 2 + 2 = 4, but other people think 2 + 2 = 5 or 2 + 2 = 7. You've got to come up with some compromise that 2 + 2 = 5.5. And that's the view that will go forward. So there's something erroneous about the nature of drafting policy via compromise and something very demotivational about the large layers of bureaucracy. But not all organizations are like that. And not even, just to be fair, I'm sure that not all ministries and organizations within the government are like that as well. Some are better run than others. But in general, it's not a great work environment. And when I was there, many people they stayed home to get work done. They deliberately avoided coming into the office to get work done because there were less distractions at home. So I accept many of the arguments around going into the office is more productive, but that's not always the case. And there's less need to go into the office now that we have better technology. So I think, allow people to work from home more it's good. You don't have to commute for hours a day. I mean, that's an enormous bonus to productivity right off the bat that needs to be taken into account.
There are also some arguments around whether people sitting at home by themselves, it could lead to atomization, and whether or not it's bad for a society as a whole to kind of not have people work together in a social way and to have decreasing social interactions. But if you've got a family and multiple people are at home, or if you've still got local things that you're doing, right, it's not, for most people, like work is not their social life. And especially in the public service, I realized when you explained your experience that if we want the public service to be more right-wing, allowing these people to work from home is probably better, because you know, then they can actually just be right-wing and not be constantly ground down and eaten up by the system. I can imagine how completely demoralizing the that public sector must be, as you've explained. So potentially working from home could be a part of making the public service more right-wing in the long run. We'll have to see how the policy develops. It's probably a small little feature. It probably doesn't make a big that big of a difference on the whole. Unfortunately, there's just not been enough clean out, as we've mentioned, in terms of these high-level roles, the government's appointments, what they're doing with the public service. You know, they've tightened things up. That's good. But there is so much work to be done. And it seems like the government's not quite progressing it enough. Maybe they're hoping that this policy can help identify more inefficiencies that they can cut. But as you've explained, I think you have explained quite well that potentially they may be introducing other inefficiencies by using this policy. Being the public service, I don't think we're actually going to notice either way, simply because of how badly things are broken.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's fair, really. I mean, the public service is, there's a lot of good people in there. There's a lot of bad people in there too. The way it's managed means that the whole is much less than the sum of the parts. You would think that with the amount of talent that there is there, you would be able to get quite good results and quite good advice out of it. Even if you just hired the good people and then had no management at all, let them do what they want, you would think that you would get much better results than what you do get. But there's something about the way it's managed and the way it's all put together that just means you get very poor quality advice and results out of it.
Well, let's try and end on a little bit of good news. The government passed a number of bills, or at least in terms of the first reading of some bills, and some of them and the others went the whole way through. So some good progress on legislation from the government, even if we had bad news from the their appointments this week. The first one that we can talk about very briefly is the charter school bill. Charter schools are going to be happening. That's great news. It's interesting. I saw that the strict standards that they were supposed to be kept to were something like 40% literacy compared to, you know, sort of, was it 40% reading at level for literacy for a charter school to be functional and to not get shut down by the government. That's kind of low. But then if it's compared to the standards for public schools, which is like zero, they can't get shut down. I guess maybe they decided to not set the expectations for charter schools too high. And we'll see how that goes. But great to see charter schools being set up.
Yeah, charter schools are great. I really support this policy. I think ACT has done a good job in getting it through. One reason it's good is that it reduces the influence of the education bureaucrats on the education of children. And it gives greater choice to parents, to local communities, the people who are setting up these schools, about the type of education and the type of teaching that they're giving to the kids. It introduces a degree of competition into the education sector. Now you've got the public schools and the charter schools, and parents can look at the quality of education being provided by each and make a choice about the type of school they want to send their kids to. Incidentally, I think that is one of the reasons that the opponents don't like them. They don't want to have to compete. They don't want to have be compared to a different educational model that very well may do a better job than they will. What I think is interesting about this, and so I've praised David Seymour, and now I'm going to point out an irony. A lot of Maori people, Willie Jackson endorsed charter schools. I think the Iwi chairs for him like charter schools.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed someone, Haumoana Gray, who worked with one of the large Maori groups, and they were like all on board. They were working on charter school applications last time, and then they got the phone call from the Labour Party and they had to shut it all down. So behind the scenes, they were all, you know, massively in favour of this.
And the reason they're in favour of it is that it allows education tailored specifically to Maori, so Maori-centric education. And David Seymour, this is an interesting irony, David Seymour, when it comes to charter schools, understands and accepts that it's good for different groups of people to have an education experience tailored to them. But that sort of goes against his one law for all idea somewhat, and it goes against his idea of a one size fits all universal multicultural liberal democracy where the same rules apply to all. So if he can accept that Maori may do better and may prefer an educational experience tailored specifically to them, all I'm asking from him is that he scales that reasoning up to the level of a nation and to a level of a government, and ask him why he can't understand the idea that a specific nation or a specific people or a specific culture don't also prefer a certain style of a government and a certain style of institutions. Why can't he apply that reasoning at a higher level to a more broader range of institutions than just schools? That would be my question to him.
And charter schools are excellent in terms of that subsidiarity principle, you know, bringing down the level at which the decisions are made to, say, a local community about their school, and they can choose how they want the education to happen. They can support schools in particular areas that do, you know, education in the way that they want it to happen. And it's sort of always been an option, but you have to pay for it. You know, I have the same thing. My kids go to a private Christian school. Like, we have to pay through the nose for that to get the education that we want. And obviously with something like a charter school, well, then you can get it for quote unquote free, because obviously you're paying taxes for all of the schools anyway. And so ideally people shouldn't be paying taxes for them twice. They shouldn't be paying the taxes for the public schools and then paying it again. So charter schools do help to fix that problem. But the thing that's not going to convince any current private schools to switch over to this is basically the threat that these schools might be destroyed. That's the downside here still, is the Labour Party is still promising that they're going to destroy these charter schools the first opportunity that they get, which is also why I'm very glad that the government listened to my recommendation. Not that they would have heard it from me, but I've been saying this since election night. I said they need to ram through charter schools and make hundreds of them as fast as they can. Within the first year, they need to have dozens of charter schools up and running. We're a little bit behind schedule there, but that was the most important thing, because the more charter schools they can get up and running, the less likely that the Labour Party can destroy them. And I'm glad they've made that a focus. But and I think in they've also promised 10-year contracts as well to these schools, so that, say, if a Labour government does get in, that they can't just get rid of them right away. There's also a little bit of a risk there, in my opinion. Like, an average national government lasts for like 9 years. So if you give them a 10-year contract, that seems just a little bit too risky. But hopefully they plan to open, I think they plan to open at least dozens every single year. I think that's a little bit on the low side. They should be going more like closer to 100 at least every year. But then you've spread them out a little bit, and you've made sure that the Labour Party can never, ever turn that back, because that could transform this country. Simply lifting the quality of education from abysmal to what would be excellent if we had proper competition and choice and the ability for parents to have a complete range of choices in education and be able to make comparisons with schools. Because that's an ongoing issue that I'm hearing from parents, especially my wife is speaking with parents at, say, preschool and other play groups and so on. And these mothers always complaining about, you know, the school's terrible and they can't find another school, they can't afford another school. And to the point as well, I mean, this is a slight, you know, off topic a little bit and a different subject, but especially in this part of Auckland where European New Zealanders are a minority, you get cases with classes and schools where their kid may be the only European kid in the class or in school and is being racially bullied. And so they want to move their kid to a different school, or they decide to move away. That's, you know, all of that stuff is terrible. Charter schools can actually really help to just fix that problem, which is a problem that's going to be getting worse in different parts of the country if charter schools are, you know, defeated, if they can't solve these problems.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with everything you just said there. This is a really big fault line between right and left. For the right, providing excellence and quality in education is very important. For the left, using the education system to ensure equality of outcomes, equality of opportunity is really the key aim. And those two things are in conflict. You can't really do both of those things at the same time.
I mean, we don't even really get true equality of opportunity always, but at least having some freedom of opportunity is perhaps the most ideal outcome, because at the end of the day, you can't really ensure that everyone's going to get the same chance, at least a good chance. You can always ensure that everyone gets the same bad options, and that's really the same bad opportunities even. And that really seems to be the problem this country has been stuck in for a long time. And what great news to have that resolved. Now, we're very close to running out of time now. We may just very quickly touch on one more issue. Greenpeace protests. There have been several bills passed now that Greenpeace is protesting against. Changes to the foreshore and seabed. Slightly different subject, but I know fixing up some of the issues with claims on the foreshore and the seabed, fishing rights and so on. Also, petroleum exploration has been reinstated. And as we know, mining permits are being opened up again. And this has resulted in these Greenpeace protests. And so a retort here from Shane Jones saying that Greenpeace are blood-sucking vermin after they protest mining. What's your overall view on the economic situation here for the bills that the National Act and New Zealand First government is passing in this area? And do you think that Greenpeace will be successful in sort of chasing away oil exploration groups, mining groups, and so on?
The real conflict between the desire of people in the provinces to have, you know, investment and industry and job opportunities in some of these primary and extractive sectors, and the desire of environmental groups to shut it down to protect the environment. And some of these environmental groups explicitly have the goal of degrowth now, where they think that putting economic growth in reverse is explicitly a good thing. They say that. This goes back to what the precursor to the Green Party, the Values Party in the 1970s, thought, that economic growth was inherently a bad thing. We needed to put economic growth in reverse. So this is really, I don't agree with that thinking at all.
No, obviously not. But that's the idea. It's like growth is what kills the planet. You know, that sort of growth will destroy us, and so we need to stop growing. But there's fundamentally an anti-human perspective. Like as humanity, what we do is we grow and we develop and we invent new things and we build wealth and build new nations and explore and dig things out of the ground. And that's part of, that's what it means to be human almost. And they seem to be very much opposed to that. They want to sit around and hold hands and have some fanciful utopia. There's no drive to improve.
No, and the big risk here is that if and when the Labor government comes back in, they can just reverse these laws. And the threat of that happening is really considerable for mining companies, for oil companies. That threat of it being shut down really hampers their ability to invest, or their willingness to invest, because they can put all this money into doing it and then the kibosh gets put on it when the Labor government gets in again. So there really needs to be action taken to reduce that investment risk. And the ACT Party, Simon Court, has proposed some sort of cross-party agreement on natural gas. That something like that needs to happen across sort of the petroleum and mining and minerals sector to reduce this investment risk problem. I don't have all the answers about how you could do it, but I think something in that direction is really what is needed.
That's one solution. You know, the other solution is, of course, to just permanently defeat the left and just make sure they can never get back into power ever again. You know, that maybe we can dream. Okay. Well, that's all that we have time for today. Thank you again for joining me, William. And to all of your listeners, please send in your feedback, send in questions, any subjects you might want us to cover next week as well. You never know. And I'll just remind everyone to the Zeitgeist on Twitter. Just search for William McGimsey. Great commentary throughout the week. Would encourage you to follow him.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.